study His Word, to determine, find the evidences of its truth, to learn how carefully to interpret it, to know exactly what His will is. We hope that each of you will have a full lifetime to spend in serving the Lord and in spreading His Word. The way the communists are extending their power throughout the world and even having their representatives make such difficulties in our national capital that it can be represented throughout the world as if our nation is just about to fall to pieces makes one wonder whether in 5 years from now we may all be in concentration camps. It could very easily come to pass. And it would be a very wonderful thing, I think, in showing the world that Americans do not stand for communism, if this Saturday a larger group could be in Washington than was there 2 weeks ago for the communist demonstration. Now, the seminary has two buses going down, and it's quite reasonable, the cost. Of course, you can go in private cars. There's plenty of parking space, but I do hope that a great many of our people will join in being there and in marching and in showing the world that we stand for victory over communism and that we would like to have 30 years instead of 4 or 5 in which to continue to preach the gospel. Now we're speaking about the book of Deuteronomy. We're speaking about, that is, about the, this is number 15, the claim of the critics, the part of the development theory, that certain parts were appropriate to certain times, and under that their main argument is the book of Deuteronomy. Properly speaking, the book of Deuteronomy is not involved much in the partition argument, because they claim that a few verses here and there of Deuteronomy are from other documents, and some will say a few, very few verses in earlier books are from Deuteronomy, but those will be disputed even by the critics. After that, they will say that that section in Joshua is really by part of the D document, that part about the schismatic altar across and how the people were able to fight to stop it. And they will say that many passages through the historical books, many passages in Joshua, in Judges, and in Kings, strangely none in Samuel, but many in Kings, they will say, are definitely Deuteronomistic. Wherever in Kings it says the high places, he was a good king, but the high places were not removed. They say this was inserted by the Deuteronomy. So if you were studying the historical books, the matter of partition and the claim that parts of them are from the D document would be a very vital matter. But as far as the Pentateuch is concerned, the D document is pretty much in one place. It is the partition arguments enter very slightly into it. But it has a very important part, as we have seen, in the matter of the argument of development. And in this phase of the that which grew into the Groth-Wellhausen theory, the theory of Divetti, which we made number 2 under A, the theory of Divetti made a cornerstone of the development theory and has a very important part to play in it. As I mentioned to you, B.W. Anderson, in his book Understanding the Old Testament, which was so widely used and is so widely used in dozens, perhaps hundreds of colleges and universities throughout the country, in his first edition of it dogmatically said that the D document came after P and was united with it later. And certainly from a view merely of partition, that would be much more logical, because Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Numbers, they divide up almost entirely into J, E, and P. And D practically doesn't enter, and it would be quite a simple matter just to add D at the end. But that is leaving the whole basic foundation of the Wellhausen theory. And I think he came to realize that, or perhaps others went to him and criticized his book on that ground. At any rate, in his second edition of the book that came out about 4 years ago, he very quietly, while he keeps most of the book identical, he very quietly changed the dogmatic statements about the D document having been added at the end to say that J, E, and D were united together, and then the P was added later. And of course, that's a much more complicated thing from a purely partition view, because it means that P was made the very foundation of Genesis and was interspersed in Exodus, Numbers, and Leviticus after Deuteronomy had been added to them, according to the theory. Now we mention number one under A, the claims of the book. We notice that there is no book that makes more claims in the Pentateuch to be by Moses. You have no claim anywhere in the book of Genesis that it was written by Moses. Genesis seems a natural introduction to the five books. It gives that which precedes it, forms the origin, the background of it. But there was nothing in Genesis that Moses would have seen personally, that he could personally have observed. He must have had documents or sources from which to construct the book of Genesis, undoubtedly. Then when you come to Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, you have a few statements that God commanded Moses to write certain things down. But when you come to Deuteronomy, it is explicitly said, these are the words that Moses said. And it is repeated in various places that Moses then proceeded to say this, and he then proceeded to say that, and this is the final song of Moses, these are the final words of Moses, and God commanded Moses to write these things down, and God commanded that the Israelites write the whole law on the altar in Mount Ebal. And so while we can find evidence to feel convinced that it is a proper viewpoint that the whole Pentateuch is by Moses, and certainly is that is the attitude taken toward it by the rest of the Old Testament, if our semester went on till July instead of stopping next week, I would assign you all to go through the rest of the Old Testament and the New and note the evidences relating to events or laws in the Pentateuch which are related to Moses. Maybe you'll all enjoy doing that in some later year after you've finished your seminary course. But we merely summarize that there is abundant evidence that it was considered in Old Testament times as by Moses, the whole law. And in New Testament times, it's very definitely referred to as by Moses, and that was the view of the Jews ever since. But as to the claims made in the book itself, Deuteronomy, above all books, specifically claims that it is the work and the writing of Moses. And yet we have number two, as we noticed last time. Number two was that Devetti's theory, the theory that this book of Deuteronomy fits with the circumstances and situation in the time of Josiah. It fits with the reforms which Josiah performed, the active endeavors he made to establish the religious life upon certain lines, that therefore it must have been the book found in the temple as described in 2 Kings and in 2 Chronicles, and that the book had for its primary purpose the getting all of the sacrifices concentrated in Jerusalem so that the priests of Jerusalem would have a great addition to their income. You might say it's part of the economic theory of history, which even though the higher criticism is not taught as widely, at least in detail as it was a while ago, is perhaps taught more widely than before. And in most of our universities, most historical events are attributed to the desires of individuals to get a better living for themselves, a better salary, a better income, and so on. And we must admit that with most people, there are many, many places in their life where this is a very important factor. People sometimes ridicule ministers for getting a call to a church that has a bigger salary than the other church, and then looking for the Lord's will in the matter, and always finding that the church that had the bigger salary was the one the Lord wanted them to go to. I had an associate at Princeton Seminary who also studied in Berlin when I was there, and he was so disgusted at this widespread attitude that he told me he was going to adopt the principle that if offered two positions with differing salaries, you should always take the one with the lower salary. And if offered two positions, one of which had more prestige, you should always take the one with less prestige than the other. Well, he was a man of real ability and real love of the Lord, and I had had little contact with him for 30 years, but I was glad to hear later that he was in a position of considerable prominence in a very different part of the country than this, and it made me feel that he had not gone from one extreme to the other, as we're so prone to do. We should not take the place that's more better paying or the place that's poorer paying, but the place where we can serve the Lord best. And we may have better opportunities in either one than the other, and that should be what decides. But most people are affected by economic consideration. And it would not be at all strange if among the priests in Jerusalem there were those who felt that if only these sacrifices that are brought to all these places could be concentrated in Jerusalem, think how much more income we would have. And so Devetti's theory sounded very reasonable, that it was these priests who had this idea in mind, this purpose, who manufactured this book and who made it look like an old book and hid it in the temple in such a way that it would be sure to be found there. Now then, we will take as capital B, difficulties with the central critical claim regarding Deuteronomy. Difficulties in the central critical claim regarding Deuteronomy. And the first of these is that as originally held, number one, as originally held, it represents the book as the result of a pious fraud promulgated to deceive Josiah. Now, this is not a phrase used in order to ridicule or to oppose the view of the critics. This is a view which they themselves propounded, that it was a pious fraud. That is, that we're going to do a lot of good things. We're going to have a lot of good information, good advice in this book. But in order to get it across, they were going to pretend that it was something that it is not. And it's amazing how often people are able to convince themselves that by doing a certain amount of evil, they can produce good. But God never justifies evil. And God, even if his own people fall into sin, he may even turn his favor entirely away from them, even though the people they oppose are far worse than they are. God calls upon us to seek to establish and hold principles of righteousness in our lives, even if we seem to lose out for a time by it. Some time ago, I had a friend, a student of mine at another seminary before I taught here, who was in Wildwood, New Jersey. And there he said in his church there was a man who had a big garage. And he said that this man had this garage, and the man was a very devoted member of the church. And he said, "I do not believe that I or my men should work on Sunday." And so every Sunday his garage was closed tight. And all his friends said, "How foolish." They said, "Wildwood, down there, a resort city by the sea, has got five times as many visitors on Sunday as there ever are on any other day of the week. They have breakdowns in cars. They have difficulties. You're going to go bankrupt." "Well," he said, "if the Lord wants me to go bankrupt, I'll go bankrupt. But," he said, "I'm going to stand by the principles that I believe the Word teaches, and I believe that I should not have my garage open for repair work on Sunday. If people run out of gasoline, if people have a sudden emergency, there are other places that are open. They will take care of them in such emergencies. So I'm not causing people great difficulty by closing up on Sunday, but the ordinary repair things, which most of the work is after all," he said, "if they want me to do it, I'll do it during the week." Well, his friend said, "It's nice to see a man who has strong convictions, but you'll go to the poorhouse with your strong convictions," he said. And for a while it looked as if they were right. For a couple of months, two or three months, why his business He didn't have half of what the rest of the people in the town had. It looked as if he really was headed for disaster, but he said, if the Lord wants me to have disaster, I'll stand for his truth anyway. And then people began to see a strange thing. They began to see people coming in on a Monday and on a Tuesday, driving 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30 miles to bring their cars to him to ask him to do repair work on them. And they said, why do these people come way down here to Wildwood to have repair work done on their cars when they could get it done much nearer home? None of the other places in town were getting people from a distance like that during the week at all. And somebody asked one of them, he says, why did you come way down here? Well, he said, we come here on the Sunday, have a day on the beach, we said. And he said, we thought we'd have some repair work done on our car while we were at the beach. And this was the first garage we happened to see, and it was closed. And we inquired why. And they said, oh, he won't do any work on Sunday. And we said, if there's a man whose convictions mean so much to him that he's willing to give up all the profit he could get by doing work on Sunday, that's a man who's going to be honest. And when he does something to our car, we will know that he does what he says he does, and we can trust his word. And so pretty soon, even though this man had no business on Sunday, he had more business on the rest of the week than all the rest of the garages put together. And he got material welfare rather than material poverty by his stand for what he thought was right. But he didn't do it in order to get material welfare. He did it knowing that if the Lord should send him poverty as a result, he was willing to take it because he was going to stand foursquare for the Lord's work as he understood it. And so the proposition that they make that this was a pious fraud has a great moral difficulty in it. That these people would be doing some evil in order that a lot of good would come. That they would be telling a lie in order to make income for themselves, and also they thought to do a lot of good. Now, someone today may question, because today they try to get around this largely and deny that it actually was a pious fraud. It was an accident. It got in there some way. But this is the original proposition made by the leaders of the theory. Bellhausen endorsed the statement of Ruth, one of Ruth's original propositions. You remember it was from Ruth through Vatki that Bellhausen got the development ideas. Ruth said, Deuteronomy is the book which the priest pretended to have found in the temple in the time of Josiah. And you remember that the three real founders of the Bellhausen theory, which we may call Graf Bellhausen or we may call Graf Kühnen Bellhausen, because Kühnen had really more to do with working out what the theory was to be than Bellhausen had, perhaps more than Graf either. Though Graf took the big first step and Bellhausen caused a great popularization, so very often Kühnen is sort of lost in the middle there. But Kühnen said, it is certain that an author of the 7th century B.C., following in the footsteps of others, for instance, of the writer of the Book of the Covenant, which you all know is the J.E. statement in Exodus 21-23, has made Moses himself proclaim that which, in his opinion, it was expedient to the real interest of the Mosaic party to announce and introduce. Men used to perpetrate such fictions as these without any qualms of conscience, Kühnen says. Kühnen says, if Hilkiah found the book in the temple, it was put there by the adherents of the Mosaic tenancy, or else Hilkiah himself was one of their number. And in that case, he pretended he found the book of the law. It is true this just deception is more unjustifiable still than the introduction of Moses' speaking, but we must reflect here also that the ideas of those times were not the same as ours, but considerably less strict. Well, I think honesty and truthfulness is not a new thing in modern day. In fact, it may be that there's less of it today in some regards than there used to be. But we do not find other cases in the Old Testament where something is claimed to be by Moses, which actually was something that is understood to have been introduced at the time when it was given. Cornell, one of the leading writers, says, we must recognize the fact that we have here a pseudograph, and that this was known to the persons interested. The excuse for them must be they saw no other means of carrying through their work, planned in the spirit of Moses and for the honor of Yahweh. We can plan something for a great cause and think that we will advance it by a little bit of fraud, a little bit of going contrary to sound, decent principles. But we will find that if we do, when those unsound, indecent principles we followed become known, most of the good that we've tried to do will be wrecked by them. Colenso suggested that Jeremiah himself was the one who made the fraud. He said it's obvious that very few besides the writer may have been privy to the scheme. Perhaps only the priest Hilkiah and possibly Huldah and one or two others. So Colenso thinks it's strange that when they bring in Jeremiah, because he was at the time of Josiah, that they can't agree on what Jeremiah's attitude was. Because some, like Colenso, think that Jeremiah himself wrote the book of Deuteronomy, pretending it was by Moses, while others say that the book of Jeremiah says, how hath the pen of the scribe dealt falsely? You find those words somewhere in Jeremiah, and they say that means that Jeremiah was there, recognizing the fact that Deuteronomy was a fraud. And actually, there's no reason to take it either way, of course. But they don't agree then that whether Jeremiah was for or against it. Shane, the editor of the Encyclopedia Biblica, tries to defend it. He says what Hilkiah practiced was not deceit or delusion, but rather illusion. He says in his book, The Founders of Criticism, how is it that Hilkiah, Shaphan, and Huldah display such imperturbability? The easiest supposition is that these three persons, to whom we must add Ahikam, Achbor, and Asaiah, had agreed together, unknown to the king, on their course of action. He says, I quite enter into the dislike of reverent Bible readers for the theory of pious fraud. I think that dislike an exaggerated one. No student of Oriental life and history could be surprised at a pious fraud originating among priests. Now that's a sort of a general statement, so easy to make. No student of Oriental life and history could be surprised at a pious fraud originating among priests. Well, why? What right have you to make such a statement? If you can give a few instances, you have some evidence. But when you say no student should be surprised, that's the sort of argument that is so easy to use, and I can't say I think it's always wrong to use it, in a general talk addressed to unthinking people. You say you decide in the light of careful study what you think is right. And then when you are presenting it to the mass of people, you say, why, of course, it stands to reason. And lots of people, that'll carry more weight than if you give some good, sound, considered argument. But if you're dealing with intelligent people, if you're trying to determine facts, I think it is utterly wrong to use that sort of a method. Let's see what the facts are and not simply say no student of Oriental life could be surprised. It's like the statement I read in the paper a few years ago. Somebody was speaking about this crazy habit we have in America of electing military men to position. He was criticizing Eisenhower being made president. He said, why should a military man, what facility does he have to know anything about civil government? He said, what, we do this crazy thing in America, he said. He said, can you imagine the Duke of Wellington being considered for Prime Minister of England? Well, I'm sure 99 9/10% of the people who read the statement said, well, why, of course, the people of England wouldn't consider the Duke of Wellington for Prime Minister, even if he did defeat Napoleon. Why then should we have made Eisenhower our president? But if he just bothered to pick up the encyclopedia and read the life of the Duke of Wellington, he would find out that after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the Duke of Wellington went into politics and that he tried for years to become Prime Minister of England. And after many years of effort, he succeeded and was Prime Minister for a number of years. And yet, the man doesn't say the Duke of Wellington was never Prime Minister of England. That would be an out and out lie. He just says, can you imagine the Duke of Wellington being considered? Well, you can't imagine if you don't know anything about English history, of course. But if you know anything about English history, it's exactly what happened. And that sort of argument has no place among intelligent people trying to decide what the facts are or what attitudes should be taken. But here, that is what Cheyne says. No student of Oriental life and history could be surprised at a pious fraud originating among priests. You see that it is not misrepresenting the critical theory in the least to say that as originally held, it represented the book as a result of a pious fraud promulgated to deceive Josiah. Now, it's interesting that if you will look in the Hastings Bible Encyclopedia, by the way, 40 years ago, one more than that, 60 years ago now, there were three great Bible encyclopedias prepared. One was the Encyclopedia Biblica, one was the Hastings Dictionary of the Bible in several volumes, or is it Encyclopedia? I forget the exact name. And one was the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. Now, the Encyclopedia Biblica has some articles by well-known scholars that give you some valuable material, but it is written from a thoroughly critical, thoroughly anti-Christian viewpoint. The Hastings Bible Encyclopedia is written from a generally critical viewpoint, but with much more of pious overtones than in the Encyclopedia Biblica. And it has perhaps more material in it that can be of value for us. You will occasionally find a very good article from a conservative viewpoint. And then the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which was prepared by James Orr, one of the greatest defenders of the faith, I think, in all history. His book here on the problem of the Old Testament is a very mine of material regarding the higher criticism of the Pentateuch and the rest of the Old Testament. Unfortunately, so written that if you don't know the background and understand what the theory is, you probably won't get much out of it. In fact, even if you do, you have to study it carefully. It's full of valuable material, but it has to be studied carefully. It won the Bross Prize 60 years ago for a book on religion. Now, the Bross Prize today, I suppose, goes to unbelievers. But at that time, it went to this book. Many, many copies of it were published. Most ministers of 60 years ago had it. And it is most unfortunate that this book, which so many ministers had 60 years ago, and which has such a marvelous study and examination of the critical theory in so many of its details, is written in such a way that the average man picks it up, reads a few pages, says, what a nice book. What a nice book. Someday I'm going to study it thoroughly, puts it aside and never looks at it. And we had a student come here once who said he'd had a course in the Pentateuchal criticism, and they had used Orr's book as a textbook, and I gave him a little quiz and found he didn't have the slightest idea even of the difference between J and P. And he had gotten a lot of detail with no idea of how it fits together or what it meant. If one-third of the material in Orr's book, if one-third of the valuable material had been written in a book the same size as this, but expressed in such language that the average person would catch on to what it meant, I wouldn't be surprised if it would have taken 10 years longer than it did for the critical theory to gain its widespread supremacy in the religious world of America that it has today. But it's a wonderful book, and you can doubtless pick it up in secondhand books easily because thousands of them were printed. Every evangelical minister 60 years ago felt, here's a book I ought to have. But I'm afraid most of them didn't get much out of it, though it is filled with valuable material. But Orr's book gives you not only his view, he gives abundant quotations from the critics, abundant quotations and specific biblical references at every point. He packs material into each page. And it's a great book for the scholar who's had a full year of Pentateuchal study. to take and go on with. But to start, most people just get nothing out. Yes? The title is The Problem of the Old Testament. The problem of the Old Testament, but most of it is dealing with the Pentateuchal criticism. But of course, after all, the Pentateuchal criticism is the foundation of the problem of the Old Testament. If you can accept the Pentateuch, you have no real problem elsewhere. But if you accept the critical viewpoint on the Pentateuch, you naturally go on and extend it to the other portions of the Old Testament. Yes? Well, he should be able to get a great deal out of the book. He should be a student who has a good grasp of what I've given in this course. Will find that most of the things I've given in this course, not all, because some of them deal with material sins, but most of them he will find are somewhere in the Lord. But he will find a tremendous amount of detail that I simply haven't time to give you. A tremendous amount of detail, a tremendous amount of further material. I recommend it strongly to anyone who will keep in mind the material of this course and then go on to study. But if you lay it aside for 5 years and forget what was given you in this course and then pick up four, I'm afraid you won't get much out of it. He's got a tremendous lot of material and it's very logically arranged and very well presented, but just too much for the average person to be able to digest, and it just doesn't leave an impression. While I'm mentioning that, I might mention another book that is well worth your having that is much easier to read than this, and that is the book on the Five Books of Moses by Oswald T. Allis, who was, I learned beginning Hebrew under him at Princeton. Later on, he was professor of Old Testament in another seminary, and I was assistant professor of Old Testament. I worked with him there for 7 years in this capacity. My first year there, I was assistant to Professor Robert B. Wilson. But I was assistant to Oswald T. Allis for 7 years. He has written a book. He's written another book, Attacking Premillennialism, which I do not recommend. I don't say I don't recommend it because I disagree with it. I don't recommend it because I don't think it's strictly logical. But it has had a big influence, and I think a harmful one. But his book, The Five Books of Moses, has got a great deal of valuable material in it. It is much easier reading than Orr. In fact, you might be wise, if you're going further in this subject, to master the first half of Alice's book before taking up Orr's book. Alice is not written in the condensed style of Orr. He's much easier to read. But with Alice, too, I have to say, Alice's book has not gotten near the wide reading that Orr's had. Because when Orr's book came out, most ministers in the country believed Moses wrote the Pentateuch. And they were interested in something to show the critics were wrong. Whereas when Alice's book came out, most of those who had graduated from seminaries in the previous 20 years were convinced the criticism was right. And felt a book like Alice's was rather foolish. But among those who still felt that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, Alice's book didn't have near the influence it should have had, because Alice's book rather assumes an understanding of what the critical viewpoint is. And consequently, many excellent points he gives in opposition to the critical viewpoint do not make the impression they should on those who don't really realize the force of the critical position. I think after having my course, I would recommend you, if you have time to work into this field, to work the first half of Alice's book first. And then after that, work into Orr's. Now, I say the first half of Alice's book because the last half of Alice's book deals with archaeology. And that is another area. And in that other area, Alice had not worked a tenth as much as he had worked in the field of the critical study and the answer to it. And consequently, he makes a number of statements in the latter part of his book which are entirely true, but given in different language than the ordinary archaeologists of the day would use. and therefore he will cast them aside. And he gives other statements in that area which perhaps do not show the knowledge of that field that he ought to show if he's going to deal with it in his book. But the first half of his book deals specifically with the critical arguments and has a mass of excellent material in support of it. Alice would be very valuable for anyone to have. Alice, the five books of Moses, the first half of some very excellent things. Professor Albright at Johns Hopkins University wrote a long review of Alice's book in which he started in speaking rather favorably of it, but by the time he got the end of his review, he was tearing into it. But one of the things he tears into it for is because it uses the transliteration of Young's Concordance. And Alice did that, transliterate Hebrew words into the transliteration used in Young's Concordance because he thought the average minister would understand them better. Now, actually, the transliteration of Young's Concordance, you can tell what, if you know, are familiar with that system, what the Hebrew lessons are. So what's the harm in it? But it's not a particularly good scientific transliteration. From a viewpoint of being read by scientists, it'd been better to have used a better transliteration. From the purpose Alice had in mind, probably that was all right. But I think when Albright tore into him quite so hard for that, I think he'd reached the point of irritation and was rather looking for an excuse. But he also tore into him for not dealing with any books later than 1900. And, of course, Alice deals very little with books after 1900. But the fact of the matter is that the critical viewpoint as held by most today is exactly what Wellhausen presented. And so Albright's criticism there is, in one sense, not a valid criticism. However, I have looked into, I think, everything of importance that's been written since 1900 on the field. And I don't think it makes really any difference in the dealing with the problem, but yet I do think Alice could have brought in a few references to some of these things, and I think he could have gotten a few points that would have furthered his argument well if he had done so. But those two books I would recommend. And or even the notes in the back, if that's some excellent material. Or was in England, or in Scotland rather, and by the time he wrote, the modernists were gaining the control there. And the result was Orr didn't get, he got probably much more recognition than he would today, but he didn't get the recognition he deserved. He was a brilliant man. He's written a number of other books, some of which are very, very excellent. He's done on the whole very fine work. But Orr was facing a British religious world that had just turned against the Bible so far that he made every possible concession to them in order to stand on the big main thing. And he would say, well, even supposing this were true, and supposing that were true, yet this is clearly wrong. And thus he would attack the big main features of the criticism. While Warfield, living in Princeton, with all the professors at that time in Princeton, thoroughly orthodox, Warfield took a straight down the road position of biblical inerrancy, which Orr also held. But Warfield saw no need to make any concession whatever. He wrote in absolutely clear language on some of these points. And then Carnell, who was then president of Fuller Seminary, wrote a book which was miscalled The Case for Orthodox Theology, in which he tried to represent Orr and Warfield as representing two opposite opinions regarding inspiration. And he quotes something from Orr where he would make a sort of a concession, but not a real concession. He'd say, even if this were so, yes. And yet, Warfield would say, this couldn't be so. And he quoted the two and presented it as a debate, as if, after all, regarding inspiration, Orr and Warfield take very opposite views. Carnell's book was very deceptive and very harmful in that regard, because Orr stood just as strong and just as straight on biblical inspiration as Warfield did, but he was facing those whom he wanted to show to be in error on their central point and did not feel the necessity of taking a stand on points which would logically fall from what he stood on, but which was of less importance. So that, number one, was as originally held, the book held it represented the book as a result of a pious fraud promulgated to deceive Josiah. And number two is the moral difficulty with this theory. Yeah, thank you. I meant, having spoken of the two, I was going to speak of the third. That's why I came to speak of or. Or got out is. And or, in endeavoring to get out is be, could have tried to get the people he knew were thoroughly sound and gotten them to do the work necessary to get out a big, complete encyclopedia, which would have meant some of them would have had to do a tremendous amount of work. Or he could have gotten people he knew were sound and people he thought were sound, and thus gotten the whole range of the material covered. And the result was that Orr got some writers in Isby who took rather anti-Christian views. Orr's own articles are excellent, and I think 3/4 of the articles are excellent in Isby. But you do have some articles in Isby that are definitely on the liberal side, on matters like evolution, certain other matters. There are articles that are definitely on the liberal side. Dr. Alice once said that Hastings is generally liberal but has an occasional good conservative argument. Isby is generally conservative but has an occasional definitely liberal article. And I've been disappointed in some of the articles in Isby, though others of them are very excellent. Yes, sir? Yes, Dr. Kyle of Xenia Seminary got out, it's now 30 years ago, that he got out a revision of Isby. I have the original one of Isby before that, and I haven't worked through the revision, but I've understood that a comparative review of the article picture. It's not my impression that any great thoroughgoing revision has been made. In 1948, Erdmann's thought of making another revision. And I happened to be in Grand Rapids, and Mr. Erdmann took me out to dinner and talked with me about the possibility of my undertaking a complete revision of Isby. Well, he talked with me about it, but that's as far as it went, and nothing more was done on it for a time. Mr. Green, who's getting out the Encyclopedia of Christianity, which covers a much bigger field but does have articles on the biblical subjects, told me 2 years ago that Erdmann had offered to buy the Encyclopedia of Christianity, two volumes are out, the third about to come, had offered to buy that from him. And he, being a little short of money at the time, seriously considered selling it, and then he became convinced that Erdmann's purpose in buying the Encyclopedia of Christianity from him was to kill it so that it wouldn't form a competitor to Isby. So therefore he refused and decided to push forward as well as he could, or as fast as he could, with getting out his Encyclopedia of Christianity. Now, Erdmann's announced about 6 years ago, long time after 48, you see, they announced about 6 years ago they were proceeding with a revision of Isby, and they have a professor in Fuller Seminary as editor of it, a man who is probably one of the most conservative men in Fuller, probably much more conservative than most of the men there. But he has some assistants who are not at all conservative. One of them wrote me and asked me to write for it, but I didn't feel I could do it under the circumstances. So that the Isby third edition has been under consideration for quite a long time. But Mr. Erdmann told me that he sold more copies of Isby every year than of any other single book he published, even one volume books, every year. So it's a real moneymaker for the firm. And as long as he can make a lot of money selling what he has, there's no great purpose in getting out something more up to date on. Yes?
How many volumes did Green cover?
10 volumes.
10 volumes?
Yes. Supposed to be 10, and in fact, he announced I was going to write the 10th volume, but at the rate he's going, I won't be living when he gets to the 10th volume. So I don't know who will write that one.
Is it generally a good book that you wrote
in? Oh, yes. Dr. Palmer, who is an excellent man, edited the first volume. And the second volume, our Dr. Cohen edited. And Palmer had already prepared half the material for it, the second volume. And There were some people who had written material that wasn't particularly good for it, but Dr. Cohen, I'm quite sure, got rid of that and got some that really was good. And a Dr. Philip E. Hughes has prepared the third one, which I understand is nearly ready for publication. But after all, it's nearly 10 years that these three have been getting out. Green has many other undertakings that he's doing. He's an able, very able man, but he's doing so many things. I don't feel quite as hopeful of getting it finished soon as I wish I could. But I think as far as it's gone, it's well worth anybody's care. But see, it's only up to, I think, C now, C or D. Yeah. Time they get the 10th, they'll be time to get a revision of the first. Well, number two then was the moral difficulty with this theory. And the moral difficulty with this theory is something which is so great that most present day interpreters try to sidestep this altogether. The great moral excellence of Deuteronomy is beyond question. All readers of Deuteronomy recognize it is a book which assails wickedness in the strongest terms. Just read that chapter where it tells if the Israelites fall into sin, what terrible punishment God will bring upon them. Oh, the awful things, the fleeing before their enemies, people far more wicked than they, suffering great losses, having terrible failures of their crop, everything you can think of will come to them if they fall into sin. Read the sections where it takes such a strong stand against vice and murder and wickedness of every kind. The strong moral stand of Deuteronomy is so great that the critics who generally tend to consider the priests as simply people looking out for a good income and the prophets as men who preached righteousness and stood against sacrifice and formalism and all of the services, the temple and that sort of thing, they speak of Deuteronomy as a prophetic book. And yet it is a book which, according to Devetti's theory, was hidden by the priests in the temple. And to combine that is very difficult. To think of a man writing a book with such very, very high moral standards as that and then pretending it was written by somebody who lived nearly 1,000 years before and had been given at that early time, it produces a moral problem that is so difficult that you will have difficulty today finding somebody who will say it was a pious thought. Today they try very hard to get around that, but it's very difficult to get around. According to the scripture, they found a book in the temple. They said, "We have found the book of the law." And Josiah said, "Great wrath hath come upon our nation because of its failure to follow the command in this book." Now to say that was a fraud and wasn't true at all, and yet holds the high moral principles that it does, is just about impossible. And so the critics have to think somebody hid it there and somebody else found it. But some of the critics, of course, particularly in earlier years, said it's ridiculous to think that somebody would go to all the work of writing this book of Deuteronomy and then just leave it to chance whether it be found or not. It must have been planned that it would be found. Yes? So we have a moral difficulty with this theory, which is so great that the critics mostly try to weasel out of it. But it is a central point in the critical theory at which there is no satisfactory answer. Number three is the historical difficulty. The
But that we look at tomorrow.